Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
What to say about Mary Roach? One of the great opportunities of having her come back, especially for the new book Gulp, which just came out in paperback, is I got the opportunity to read the book again. So as I was reading it, I got to reacquaint myself with the dogged and intrepid researchers of Food Valley, the wonders of hooping, which I never knew anything about, and what an amazing thing say saliva is and how that does so many different things. I guess if you want to say the whole, as a whole, I got reacquainted with things I never thought I knew I needed to know about myself. But I'm so glad I do right now, thanks to Mary. So through this book, through Stiff, through Spooked, I mean, there's always so much information, but always a great sense of humor that really carries you along. So since y'all probably already know her, let me just bring her up. Please help me in welcoming Mary Roach.
Hello. Hi, thank you all so much for coming out in the rain and getting wet. I know that's not a pleasant thing, and you did that for me. For me. Yes, thank you. And thank you, and also, and it's just, I don't, how many times have I been to Tattered Cover? Many, I think since Stiff, probably. Yeah, so, and so it feels like home, and it's lovely to be back here. It's a wonderful bookstore. And so tonight, I don't know how many of you are familiar with my work or not. So by way of sort of a little introduction and maybe a little warning, I like to tell a little story. And that is that not long ago, I was at the TED conference and the TED Talks, and they, not doing a talk, just there. And they have you fill out this social media, like for the community. It's a little page, so you can kind of talk to people who are there. And there's a form for you to fill out and a little box where you can upload a bio. And so I did that. I have a little bio, and I uploaded it and tried to save it. And it said, "The text you have entered has been deemed offensive and cannot be saved." This is my bio, my career, my life. So this is just, so that's me, you know, and that's me in a nutshell. So this book is about the alimentary canal, which is kind of an old-timey term for the pie hole, the food chute, the whole nine yards from nose to tail. And it is people say, "Oh, why would you want to write a book about that?" And I feel that I feel like I'm interested in things that everyone is interested in until they realize they're not supposed to be interested in those things. So I have a sense that, you know, there may be other people out there who find this interesting. And because we read so much about food, there's so many books on food and cuisine and these lyrical accounts about wonderful, excellent food and cooking. And then as soon as we start chewing, it's like it doesn't exist anymore. Well, yeah, as soon as, no, I should say, while we're chewing, we're tasting. But once it starts to go down the tube, nobody really wants to think about it. We tend to, bodily processes, we turn away from them. We find them upsetting and revolting. I would like with this book to kind of turn some of that revulsion and discomfort into a little bit of respect and maybe even awe. And so by way of doing that, I want to share with you, I'm going to read you a quote. I did not write this material. This is from a 1962 issue of the American Journal of Proctology. It's by a Dr. Walter C. Bornemeyer, and I know nothing about this man except that he wrote this. "They say that man has succeeded where the animal fails because of the clever use of his hands. Yet when compared to the hands, the anal sphincter is far superior. If you place into your cupped hands a mixture of fluid, solid, and gas, and then through an opening at the bottom, try to let only the gas escape, you will fail. Yet, the anal sphincter can do it. The sphincter can apparently differentiate between solid, liquid, and gas. It can apparently tell whether its owner is alone or with someone else. Whether its owner has his pants up or down. No other muscle of the body is such a protector of the dignity of man and so ready to come to his relief. So, ladies and gentlemen, a round of applause for the human anal sphincter. While we're at the anus, I want to read you one other thing. It's a footnote that I enjoy reading just because it's kind of fun and gives you a sense. If you don't know my books, there's a lot of footnotes that aren't like normal footnotes. They're kind of things that I stumble onto and I can't bear to leave them out, even though they don't really fit the narrative. And I'm going to try and read this without my reading glasses, which I should be able to because I've read it a number of times here. It has to do with the, there's a medical term per anum, which means via the anus. You can deliver medicine that way. If it's can't go down this way, you can give it that way should you need to, per anum. But there's also a term per annum with two N's, meaning yearly. The correct answer to the question, what is the birth rate per anum, is zero. One hopes. The internet provides many fine examples of the perils of confusing these two. The investment firm that offers 10% interest per annum is likely to have about as many takers as the Nigerian screenwriter who describes himself as, quote, capable of writing 6 movies per annum. Or the Sri Lankan importer whose classified ad declares 3,600 metric tons of garlic wanted per annum. Yeah. Anyway... So, my books tend to be, they're not, this is not a comprehensive guide to the entire digestive tract and how to keep it healthy. This is not Dr. Jensen's guide to better bowel care here. This is me kind of hopscotching around and stopping where I found things to be really interesting. But I, wherever I stopped along the way, I try to find a place to go. A setting, a narrative with people, researchers sometimes, but not always, doing interesting things, having conversations, things I can describe. For example, I was in, for the mouth, I spent some time in Food Valley where there's physicists who study the physics of Crispy Crunchy. There's a guy who has studied chewing for 30 years and was so, it was talking about, you know, the everybody thinks the jaw muscles and the teeth are just these sort of strong He-Man things, but they're very sensitive. In fact, like when you bite down on a peanut, as the peanut gives way, the jaws can sense this change in the pressure and they'll cut out. So your molars don't continue to hurtle together with this great force and smash and break themselves. So there's this, they call it the quiet period. Just as the peanut breaks, the muscles stop. I thought that's pretty, you know, that kind of thing where you don't, you know, you chew peanuts all the time and, or I do, and you don't, I don't know, you don't really appreciate this thing that your jaw muscles are doing for you, like faster than a, you know, an airbag inflates, your muscles are responding. Anyway, Food Valley was a place I went for the mouth, also a pet food tasting panel, which it's in the book. And then moving on, the stomach, I spent some time with, there's a researcher who brought a competitive eater into radiology department and along with a regular control person and lots of hot dogs and a side of barium. And we looked at what exactly is going on. So the stomach, that was one of the stomach chapters. And then moving along through the intestines, we come finally to the rectum. And I thought, well, where am I going to go for this? I mean, there's no Center for Rectal Research. There's no real kind of place that scientists gather to study the rectum. So I got this bright idea because I thought, okay, well, what is the rectum? It is a storage facility. It's a facility where, you know, you've got your waste is building up, and at a certain point you've got to empty the bin, but you don't have to empty it right when it's full. You got some time. It's parked there. You have this storage facility. I thought, okay, who takes advantage of the rectum as a storage facility? And I thought, you know, I have an idea. I called the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation because the alimentary canal gets used as a sort of criminal accomplice by drug mules and other people smuggling things. You can put it down this way or you can put it up that way or that way, depending on your gender. So so I called the public affairs officer, Mr. Paul Verkey, and I explained myself as best I could, and I fully imagined that he would either hang up on me or politely say that he'd get back to me and then not get back to me. But in fact, he said, you know, at Avenal State Prison, we have a big, big problem with rectal cell phone smuggling. So if you'd like to come out, we can set you. You can talk to some guards. You can talk to the he said, you know what? I know just the inmate for you to talk to. We can set up an interview with this guy. And he said, will 4 hours be enough time? I'm like, to talk to a stranger about his rectum? I think so. Yeah, so that was an interesting afternoon. And that brings me to a special offer that I have. I have these. This is a cell phone pouch that is about the size of the human rectum. And I had these printed up. It says Gulp, and it has the first line from the Avenal State Prison chapter. It says, should circumstance prevent a man from carrying his cigarettes and cell phone in his pants pocket, the rectum provides a workable alternative. And I'm just going to say, you know, these promotional items, you can get anything printed on them, and they won't ask. They're just like, when do you need them by? They're like, they don't... just not interested in why. Why would you have had this printed on your microfiber cell phone or sunglasses pouch? So this is, and I was giving these away with the purchase of two books, but we've had a bit of a run on them. So I have, I think I have about five of them tonight, and they will be sort of randomly awarded for outstanding performance in book purchasing. So I will make some random calls as the line moves along, but and I'm sorry I don't have more of them. We had more double purchasers than I ever could have imagined. So let's see. Let's back it up from the rear end and talk a little bit. I like to talk about saliva because, first of all, it's kind of an amazing substance, but it is... It's fascinating because it is such a universal, it's kind of a universal taboo, a subject of disgust, but only when it leaves the confines of the self, the body, as long as it's in, like a lot of bodily fluids, as long as they stay in there, you know, we got no problem with them. It's just when they come out, we're like, huh. And there's a psychologist, Paul Rozin, at the University of Pennsylvania, who for a long time did a lot of interesting studies on the emotion of disgust. And he did this one. We had people imagine a bowl of their favorite soup and say how likely would they be to consume this soup on a scale of 1 to 10. And people are like, oh, 10, yeah, sounds good. And then he'd say, okay, now imagine the same bowl of soup and imagine that you have just spit in it. Now, how likely are you to consume? And it goes down to zero because it's outside the body now. And then he also talked about you can kind of map the boundaries of the self by, you know, if you've got food on your tongue and you stick out your tongue, that's still considered inside the body because you'll bring your tongue back in and you won't be grossed out. You also extend the boundaries of the self to the people you love. Whether a spouse or girlfriend, boyfriend, or your children, you go, it's okay, they're kind of part of me. So it doesn't disgust you in the same way, which I thought, so the book gets a little philosophical here and there. Also, the section on the human microbiome, which is the unbelievable wealth of colonic bacteria that we all have inside us. And one of the researchers that I spoke to about the topic of fecal transplants, which we don't need to get into now. We could get into later. I don't know. But anyway, he was talking about how, you know, there's cell by cell, 9 of them to 1 of you. He said it's almost is a philosophical question of who owns whom. And he said, you can't think of them as interlopers or sort of invaders. He said, they are a functioning organ of the body. There's been a real change in attitudes about using antibiotics. You know, it just sort of feels, having written this book, the idea of going on an antibiotic would feels kind of like mass murder to me now. Obviously, if you need it, you have to have it. But anyway, so that's something that we don't need to get into the details of. But if you have questions, we can talk a little bit about that. Publicity efforts for this book, I wanted to share with you. They've not been without their challenges. Because the topic is a little difficult, my publicist, my lovely publicist, Erin at W.W. Norton, set up, when the hardback came out, she set up a lunch. She invited food writers, like people who write for, you know, gourmet and food and wine and all kinds of sort of high-end eating magazines. And it was at this nice restaurant in New York. And I heard about it, and I wrote a note to Erin, which I pasted here. It says, "Hi, Erin, should I try to tie the content of the talk and the book to the menu for the meal? It would be easy enough. Just make sure there's beans on the menu so I can talk about flatus research. I could introduce people to topics like tooth pack and intraoral bolus rolling and the miraculous gush of saliva that protects your tooth enamel when you drink something acidic." This is what I sent to her. She wrote back almost immediately, "Dear Mary, I love that you're having fun with this. But I do think for the purposes of the lunch, we may not want to be too graphic. Perhaps you ought to highlight the olive oil tasting chapter." Fortunately, Erin isn't here tonight. So we can talk about flatus research. And I do want to talk a little bit about it because I think it is surprising that I was surprised anyway, the creativity that is applied to the study of human intestinal gas. And it dates back to the 1800s, which is in the book. But the one that we're going to fast forward, the one that I love is this is from the UK in the late 50s, early 60s, I forget. Anyway, this was done the way you would think it would be done, which is a tube and a collecting chamber. This work was done, I mention it mostly because I need to tell you the name of the man who did this work. His name was Colin Leakey. Yes, his name. It is possible he pronounces it Colin, and I don't care. To me, he's Colin Leakey. Colin Leakey. I had this came up. This happened. This book. I don't look for these things. There's so many of them, including when I called UCSF. It was time for me to get a colonoscopy, and so I called the PR office at UCSF where I live, and I'm like, who'd be a good kind of guide, because I want to not get sedated and see my colon, and who might be a good person to kind of point out the highlights along the route? And she said, we're going to hook you up with Dr. Turdeman. Jonathan Turdeman. And she's like, and I'm like, wait, back it up. Is this Jonathan Turdeman? She says, yeah, you know. So I go in there and I explain that I don't want to be sedated and blah, blah, blah. And he goes, okay, yeah, before we begin, do you have any questions? I said, yeah, just one. How many times a day do you have to answer to a comment about your name? And he was completely deadpan, goes, what do you mean? I also, I don't usually go on about this, but I'm on a roll. Okay, saliva chapter. I was talking about how there are enzymes in saliva and elsewhere in the digestive tract that break down protein, fat, starch. And basically, laundry detergent is a digestive tract in a box because they have these very enzymes in them, including the saliva one, amylase, which breaks down starch. And I wanted to ask, like, who had the bright idea to put digestive enzymes into detergent? So I call the American Cleaning Association, and the guy, the PR guy, goes, okay, yeah, because I said, you know, saliva has amylase, which breaks down starch. Who first did that? Who first put the... He goes, I'm going to put you in touch with Dr. Louis Spitz. And I called Dr. Spitz. And Dr. Spitz, first of all, see, there's no glee. Like the guy, the PR guy is like, yeah, Dr. Louis Spitz, does this not strike you as amusing? Then Dr. Spitz goes, I do soap, not detergent. So I'm going to put you in touch with someone who's more of an expert in detergent. His name is Keith Grime. without a trace of glee again. So I don't know. I seemed these things just fell in my lap for this book, like my food, which and I use saliva as a pre-soak. I recommend it. Let's see. So anyway, where were we? Oh yeah, we were at Flatus. Okay, now that moving forward from Colin Leakey, we have the Michael Levitt, who is, by the by, the brother of Stephen Levitt, Freakonomics. I know. Yeah, you don't hear Stephen Levitt talk very much about his brother Michael. Michael Levitt has published 34 papers on human intestinal gas, including in the New England Journal of Medicine. He is the gas guy. If you look him up on Google Images, you'll see four or five pictures of him and then a picture of a can of baked beans. Michael Levitt came up with a couple of very creative ways for, if you're going to study human flatus, you need to gas, you need to trap it, you need to catch it in order to measure it and study it. He came up with, he invented the Mylar flatus trapping pantaloons. That was one. And also the flatographic recording technique. This is the New England Journal of Medicine that this was published in. The flatographic recording technique is very simple. It is a piece of paper and a pencil, and when you fart, you make a mark. It's a simple tally. I think a problematic methodology in that if you are the kind of person, given the same volume of gas, you might have one person who is sort of dainty and lets it out in lots of tiny squeakers, so has a tally of 15, and then you have someone like, no need to mention names, in my family, who lets it out in one big sort of gale. That's one mark. So it would appear that this dainty person is more flatulent. So it's not the best technique, I feel. It is not used anymore. What is the state of the art now is the breath hydrogen test. And that's used by the people who make Beano, which is the drops that you put on beans. They've done studies to test their products, and they use this test where you eat a lot of beans. You start out with a big old container of beans, and then you wait a while, and you exhale into a Mylar bag. And depending on how much hydrogen you're exhaling, with hydrogen being a main breakdown product of the beans in your colon, you can extrapolate how much is coming out the rear end based on how much you're exhaling. So it's kind of a tidy, more comfortable way to study the individual differences in flatus. I visited the labs at Beano and I asked if I could participate. They were doing a study at the time. And Dr. Kligerman, the person there, said, well, yep, but we need to test first, make sure that you are a producer. So I went and I ate the beans, and I'm not ashamed to say I am a producer. I believe my husband is an executive producer. Anyway, so flatus. We'll set that aside for now. I'm going to read you a short section, and then I'm going to open it up for questions, because people have truly amazing questions with this book, as you could well imagine. Those who know the human gut intimately see beauty not only in its sophistication, but in its inner landscapes and architecture. In a 1998 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, two Spanish physicians published a pair of photographs. One was the haustrations of the transverse colon. The other was a photograph of the arches of an upper floor arcade in Gaudí's La Pedrera. Inspired and wanting to see my own internal Gaudí, I had my first colonoscopy without drugs. There is an unnameable feeling I've had maybe 10 times in my life. It is a mix of wonder, privilege, humility. I felt it in a field of snow on the outskirts of Fairbanks, Alaska, with the northern lights whipping overhead so seemingly close, I dropped to my knees. I am walloped by it on dark nights in the mountains, looking up at the sparkling smear of our galaxy. Laying eyes on my own ileocecal valve, peering into my appendix from within, bearing witness to the magnificent complexity of the human body, I felt, let's be honest, mild to moderate cramping. but you understand what I'm getting at here. Most of us pass our lives never once laying eyes on our own organs, the most precious and amazing things we own. Until something goes wrong, we barely give them thought. This seems strange to me. How is it that we find Christina Aguilera more interesting than the inside of our own bodies? It is, of course, possible that I seem strange. You may be thinking, wow, that Mary Roach has her head up her ass. To which I say, only briefly and with the utmost respect. Thank you. Thank you so much. I would like to open up the audience to questions. I have you can ask me about any of my books, my personal life, my really my day, anything. And I will repeat the question because we are this is being podcast, so I will do that. I will dutifully repeat the question. So let the fun begin. Yes.
What's your next topic?
Oh, I cannot say. All right, it is a book. It is a book. A hint. Hard to hint. Yeah. Yes.
How many researchers do you have working with you?
Zero. Oh, yeah, you know what? How many researchers do I have? I didn't even repeat the question. How many researchers do I have working with me? No, I do all my own because I never really know what I'm looking for until I stumble onto it. That's the kind of scatterbrained researcher I am. So I do it. And it's also so fun. I really enjoy it. So no, I have no researchers. I am my own researcher. Yes.
I'm not familiar with your work and it's a pleasure to meet you. Just looking at the books here. How do you come across your topics? What inspires you?
How do I come across my topics? Sometimes it's one book leads to another, something in one book, like Stiff kind of led to Spook. Other times I will be reading something and it's one of those aha moments. For example, for Bonk, which has to do with sex labs and people studying sexual physiology in a laboratory setting. Awkward. That one, I was reading about Masters and Johnson, and there was a reference to the colposcopic films of Masters and Johnson. I went, wait. Does that mean like cervical? Like, are you filming inside the woman's body while she's doing sexual things? Yes, indeed. They made an artificial coition machine, a phallus with a camera. I'm like, sex research, next book. So that sometimes it happens like that. Other times it's this one, I ran across something in the last book that kind of sparked an idea to maybe do something. And then I thought, yeah, Alimentary Canal, like, duh, Mary Roach. It's such an obvious, why didn't I do that before? So it's different ways. Different ways. Yes. What was my most awkward moment in this book? That's easy. You go into a prison and you sit down with a man who, by the way, is serving a life sentence for murder, and you have a list of questions about this man's rectum and the things he puts in it. And that's really hard to describe how odd that is. But because hooping, as it's known, putting things through the hoop, it's so commonplace in prison that I might as well, from his perspective, have just sat down to talk about, you know, tire rotation, I don't know, flossing. It was so nothing to him. He's like, yeah, what do you want to know? Everyone does it. We all do it. So that made it a little less awkward. Wait, I'll come back to you. Yeah. Do we have a question over yonder here? Really? What's wrong with this side? What's wrong with you people? Yes.
What is your background?
My background, I have a BA in psychology. I don't have a science background. So my background is, useless. For what I do. I treat my sources as unpaid tutors. I eat up huge amounts of their time. People are incredibly generous with their time and they're willing to explain things, and getting the information from a person rather than an article or someone else's book is so much more valuable and so much more, and also it's in the context of the conversations in the context of their lab and their work, and it all kind of works together. So it's actually, I don't mind, although it's somewhat embarrassing. Yes.
What's your ratio? I guess you make cold calls when you try to arrange for meetings. What's your ratio of success when you call someone, hang-ups to natural
companies? Well, we now have the wonder of email, which makes it so much easier. When I started my career, the question was, what's the ratio when you're cold calling, when you're contacting someone from out of the blue, the ratio of people who get back to you, who say yes instead of no. And it gets better with every book. As people know my work, surprisingly, they will talk to me. Just being able to send an email that kind of says, this is what I do, here's my bio, so they can think about it, and that you're not sort of taking them by surprise. That was always really hard as a journalist, to have to call someone, interrupt their day, and try to explain who you are and what you need. And so it's much easier. The ratio, I'd say one in six or seven times I don't get someone just won't write back. Yeah, no, people want to help. I think people like to help. You know, it's a thing with human beings. You say to someone, will you help me? And they say yes. It's kind of extraordinary. Yeah. You had another question.
I did. I just wanted to know the average time of research.
Well, research and writing together, 2 to 3 years. Yeah. Well, yeah. Takes a while. Yeah. A lot of setting up. A lot of, who should I talk to, and what have you got going in the lab? Oh, it's not going to be till next year. Okay, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Any topic you wouldn't do?
There's so many topics that wouldn't really work for me. For example, something that's purely abstract, because I like to be in a scene and describing things going on. So something abstract. Also something that takes place mostly internally, like thoughts or sleep or dreams. People often suggest, why don't you do a book about drugs or alcohol or sleep? And describing an internal state is it's hard to keep people, unless you're Oliver Sacks, that's a hard thing to pull off. So that I wouldn't go near. Or purely historical, even though I find the history of medicine fascinating, I'm just not enough of a researcher to do a comprehensive look at a topic, the history of X. So lots of things won't work. Most things won't work for me. I was going to say it's kind of a process of elimination. How I come by my... Yeah, so most of them like... Yes?
When did you become interested in writing?
When I worked as a copy editor and realized how poorly suited I was for this job. Copy editing requires a lot of focus on detail. You need to care that something in chapter 2 is capitalized differently than chapter 7. That needs to matter to you. And I'm the kind of person like, they won't notice. That's not a good attitude for a copy editor. So I thought, okay, maybe I should try writing this stuff. So it was more of a sideways move. Can I share some of my personal background? Yes, I'm from Hanover, New Hampshire. My dad and mom both taught at Dartmouth. My dad was 65 when I was born, which is the most shocking and surprising thing in my background. It's a fairly routine childhood. I spent a lot of time outdoors, running around barefoot in the summer, riding bikes. I have an older brother, Rip Roach, an excellent name. Rip Roach. Yeah. Yes.
I encountered your name on the back of a book by Rose George. Have you ever met Rose George?
Have I ever met Rose George? Yes, I've met Rose George. I've spent time with her at the TED Talks. We met through email years ago, having to do, she tried to get me to go to, there's a gathering of when Saddam Hussein was alive, they would have a Saddam Hussein birthday party in Iraq, and with a double, a Saddam Hussein double. She went a couple of years. She tried to get me to go. I couldn't go, but we have kept in touch. I love her. She's a wonderful writer. She has two fabulous books. The most recent one, 90% of Everything, which is about shipping. And it's so fascinating. I'm sure it's here for sale in this store. Anyway, do you're a fan, or do you know her?
You resonate. Your works resonate.
So, yeah. Yeah. No, she, yes. Anyway, she's great. Yes. My career with Reader's Digest was very, very fun and somewhat embarrassing. I don't know. People would say, "What? You stiff? Reader's Digest?" You know, it was right around the time that I was writing Stiff. I was that column. That column ended because a new editor came in and didn't want the column anymore. So, boom. That was it. Which was okay. I was running out of ideas for it, but they own the rights to it and have since put it out as a collection of columns. So that. It was just a freelance once a month, mostly about Ed, my husband Ed, who's a very funny man, much funnier than I am. Yeah. So that was my Reader's Digest career. That's all I did for them.
Well, it was very enjoyable.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Any more? Are we in the way, way back?
Okay, two questions. Back to Steph. Do you ever have nightmares from some of them?
The question was regarding Stiff, my first book. Do I ever have nightmares? Oh, so, you know, I worked on that book in 2001 and 2002. So the nightmares of long suicide. There was a period of time. There was one chapter. The first time I went and I saw some work being done on a cadaver, that I had just sort of almost flashbacks. I kept picturing the, you know, these images, and I remember not nightmares, but I remember thinking, this may have been a poor idea. I don't know about this, but you get used to cadavers quickly, as anybody who's taken anatomy knows. It becomes routine in a surprisingly quick way. And then the other question, what was? Oh, who do I like to read? I love Bill Bryson and Susan Orlean were two writers early on in the 80s who made me want to write books. If I thought if I could do that as well as they do, I would be a happy camper. So they were inspirational early on. Right now I'm reading Tim Johnston. He's got a novel coming out called Descent, which is an amazing, he before just a book of short stories, but this book, it's not out, so it's not very helpful for you, but in January, if you put it in your phones, it's really good. Anyway, I'm reading that, and I'm reading Colm McCann right now. Wow, called Dancer, which is based on the life of Rudolf Nureyev. Wow, incredible writer. Some of these fiction guys, I don't know how they do it. I don't know. Incredible. Anyway, that's it's an amazing book. So that's what I'm reading right now. Ed is great. Ed is great. Just became a grandfather. I'm a step grandmother. He's very good. Yeah. So you had a question, yes. Where do I write? I write, well, it's changed, actually. I used to just sit at a desk, and now I've become more productive in cafes. When I really need to write, there is something about hubbub and noise and music that makes me just drill down in and focus in this counterintuitive way. I do a lot of my work in my office, the research, the phoning, the emailing, but when I really need to get some work done, I go to this cafe and spend a couple of hours. That's so, yeah. And on a computer, not on paper, no. Yeah. Yes? What did I want to be when I went through a little period of time where I thought a veterinarian, because I loved animals. I still love animals. The veterinarian. And then a long stretch of time where I thought, oh, who cares? Something will come along. I really was very passive when it came to career, what I wanted to do. Yeah, I just thought, oh, I'll find something fun.
And you did.
And I did. Yeah. It's like not good advice for young people. Yeah. All right. Should we do? Okay. You had another one. I did one TED Talk, and then I went one year when Rose George was doing a talk. So we sort of met there. I've only been twice. Yeah. Okay, and one more from this side of the room, the quiet side of the room, way in the back. Yes.
So, Mary Roach, how about bugs is the next
theme? You know what? I thought about doing a book about roaches because... Because they're used, they do a lot of weird, the military does research with, there's all kinds of roach research, but it seemed a little stunty, I don't know. Roaches by Mary Roach. But bugs, someone did that, what was it, Wicked Bugs? There have been a couple, wasn't Dr. Tatiana's? So I feel like people have done that really well, so I kind of feel like it's theirs now, but it's a great idea, and I bugs are amazing. Yeah. All right, we'll end right there. Thank you so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.